I'm Adrian Finnegan. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, joining the fight against inflation, Europe raises interest rates for the first time in more than a decade. But will the measure work and what's at risk? Also this week, as interest rates rise further, highly indebted countries like Italy could get into more trouble. Will the European Central Bank come to its rescue? And European nations agree to reduce the amount of natural gas they use, but will that help them stay warm this winter if Russia stops all deliveries? Europe is struggling to put out the fires hurting its economy on several fronts, but it's the rising cost of heating homes and feeding families that's worrying many Europeans, probably the most. Annual inflation in the European Union reached almost 9% in June. The last time it was that high, the euro, which is shared by 19 of the bloc's countries, didn't exist. The European Central Bank has raised interest rates for the first time in more than a decade to try to rein in price increases. The cost of borrowing was increased by a larger than expected half percentage point. That takes the ECB's key interest rate to zero, ending the bloc's eight-year experiment with negative interest rates. June inflation was more than the bank had predicted, and the euro fell to parity with the dollar for the first time in 20 years last week. Well, the bank's president, Christine Lagarde, explained the ECB's decision to hike rates. Lagarde also gave few signals about what comes next.
Economic activity is slowing. Russia's unjustified aggression towards Ukraine is an ongoing drag on growth. The impact of high inflation on purchasing power, continuous supply constraints, and higher uncertainty are having a dampening effect on the economy. Firms continue to face higher costs and disruptions in their supply chains, although there are tentative signs that some of the supply bottlenecks are easing. Taken together, these factors are significantly clouding the outlook for the second half of 2022 and beyond.
Well, the bank also introduced a new policy tool to shield some of the bloc's most indebted nations from excessive borrowing costs. The Transmission Protection Instrument, or TPI, is intended to stop disorderly moves in government bond markets and prevent euro spreads from widening. The gap between Italian and German benchmark yields, a closely watched gauge of financial stress, grew to as much as 2.38 percentage points. Now, the tool allows the bank to buy the bonds of countries experiencing an unwarranted deterioration in financing conditions. And by doing so, bond prices go up and their yield down. And that, in theory, caps interest costs. But it wouldn't offer protection if the ECB determines that higher borrowing costs resulted from poor government decisions. Well, to discuss all of that, joining us from London, Melanie De Bono, a senior Europe economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics, an independent economic research firm. Good to have you with us, Melanie. So, the ECB's move makes sense. It's well behind its peers, though. Is it too little, too late?
The ECB raised rates by 50 basis points last week, taking its key deposit rate from minus 0.5 to zero. This was more than most of us had expected, but it's probably not enough, no. So we look for an extra 75 basis points of hikes between now and the end of the year, taking that deposit rate to 0.75%.
All right, but higher rates, it's feared, are going to push the euro bloc into recession. How far and how fast do you think the ECB should be moving rates right now?
Well, at this point, the Eurozone economy was heading into recession, whether the ECB was hiking rates or not. After the pandemic, when it seemed like supply issues were abating, the war in Ukraine broke out. So, and as a result, the Russian gas supplies have dwindled heading into Europe, and this is affecting industry, especially in the likes of Germany and Italy, which are highly reliant on those gas supplies. So we foresaw an Eurozone recession either with or without further ECB rate hikes.
Inflation across the Eurozone, Melanie, is running, it's rising about as quickly as it is across the US. Why is it so much harder for the ECB to get inflation under control than it is for the Fed?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's harder. Both are struggling at the moment because inflation is high in both places. But at this point, a lot of what is driving the inflation rate higher is energy. And that is something that the ECB cannot control. So interest rate hikes will eventually dampen inflation because they will convince, they will lead to lower demand for certain goods, convincing firms to stop raising prices. But in the meantime, it's energy that's driving inflation, and that will continue, especially if, as we saw this week with the surge in gas prices again, the energy rate will remain higher than otherwise would have been the case.
The euro gave up the early gains that it made after the ECB's decision on rates. To what extent, though, could a depreciating euro actually be better for the eurozone economy?
Depreciating euro helps exporters. So when the euro depreciates against the US dollar, European goods are relatively more cheaper for such a given price. So that means that exporters benefit because their goods are more competitive on the global market.
All right, so what would it take for the euro to make gains, to become stronger?
Well, at this point, we expect the euro to depreciate a bit further because of interest rate differential. So that's because the US Federal Reserve Bank will hike by more than the ECB over the coming months. But we do see this turning. So in September, where our US economist expects US inflation to make a turn and the Fed to start hiking by less than it's done in recent months, that is when we will see the dollar lose out compared to the euro.
Will pressure on the eurozone economy get worse if Russia carries through its threat to cut off supplies or severely reduce gas supplies to Europe?
We expect that Russia will close the taps fully before year end, and probably before Europe manages to fill its gas levels or gas supplies to the intended rate. So that is by 90% come, 80%, sorry, come November. And that will be hard. It will hurt, especially, like I previously mentioned, countries like Germany and Italy, which are highly exposed to this Russian gas. But it's not something that Europe can't adapt to. So a lot of European countries have already ramped up coal production. And it seems also that nuclear production may come back online in Germany.
Our discussion so far has been pretty pessimistic, Melody. Is there anything positive to say right now about the eurozone economy?
Tourism is expanding at breakneck speed. It, of course, took a large hit during the pandemic, and now it's on a tear. So if tourism wasn't rebounding to the extent that it was now, we'd probably see a much deeper recession in the eurozone in the coming two quarters than we currently expect.
Melanie, there are concerns about how higher borrowing costs are going to affect indebted nations. That's something I want to talk to you about a little more in just a moment. Stay with us. Well, Italy is among those countries. It has the second highest debt burden in the eurozone, and raising interest rates too quickly could hike up Italy's debt and make it harder for it to pay. It comes as the country faces political uncertainty after the resignation of Prime Minister Mario Draghi. We'll get more into the details on how the TPI works, which we told you about, in a few moments. But first, let's hear how some Italians are coping.
Can I sell for €4 what I was selling at 2 before? You know what they tell me here? To close. So all of these price increases are paid for by us, the small, medium business owners.
I'm anxious because you try to not turn on the air conditioning, take the car less, but there's still anxiety because you have to think twice about doing things that were normal before. So we simply need to pay more attention.
It's impossible to get ahead this way, between taxes, bills and everything else. It's impossible to get ahead. I worked from the morning until late, more than 10 hours. And for what? To pay the bills?
So let's get back to Melanie De Bono, a senior Europe economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics. So, Melanie, concern growing over a return to the eurozone crisis that broke out in 2010. What are the chances of that?
Debt servicing costs will rise. So because the ECB is hiking up interest rates, government bond yields will rise in Italy, and especially because now the ECB has ended its QE program and it's no longer hoovering up all the new debt that the Italian government is issuing. So any market participants who are buying that debt are much more price sensitive and will require a higher premium to buy that debt. in turn, the government is still issuing new debt because it is having to spend a lot more on trying to appease, trying to offset the rising cost of living. And because now, of course, it has to invest in the green transition and it has to spend more because of the events, because of the risk that's on its doorstep. So it's spending a lot more. It's having to issue new debt, and therefore debt servicing costs will rise and the debt burden will rise. Do we think it's going to lead to a new debt crisis? No, we don't think so. The debt is more manageable now, and we think that the relationship between government bond yields and nominal debt is much more benign than it was in 2012. Plus, if we were heading in that direction, the ECB would be much more willing to come to the rescue for Italy now compared to the intransigence of 2012.
All right. Do you think that the TPI will work if indeed it is even used? Do you think it's going to be used? And is it just me, or have the details been left deliberately vague?
It's not just you. The ECB President Christine Lagarde said that they will not tell us everything about the TPI. We do have some information, and that's basically that the TPI is like a form of asset purchase program, but of course not exactly like QE. So it's, in simple terms, a promise by the ECB that it will buy certain government's bonds if it thinks that bond yields are rising much more quickly than the fundamentals would imply. There's a number of conditions on this, such as fiscal sustainability. It really just depends how strictly the ECB enforces those conditions, whether or not it will be helpful for countries like Italy or not. It's very easy to see some of the governing council members, warning, putting up headline signals that they don't want to support some countries because of past fiscal sustainability worries. So who knows if it will help and who knows if it will be used.
OK, Christine Lagarde declined to say whether Italy is actually on the list, given the political crisis. Could Italy even meet TPI's conditions? I'm guessing from what you were saying earlier that it possibly could. And what does all of this mean for investors?
So at this point, Italy probably does meet the conditions, yes. But of course, we're heading for snap elections. So as we do head for snap elections, we expect Italian bond yields to rise. And that's based on political uncertainty. And that's one of the things that the TPI conditions set out. If the bond yields are rising and spreads are widening because of political, self-inflicted political uncertainty, then it wouldn't warrant use of TPI. So we'll have to wait and see whether or not, at this point, what happens in the coming months will lead the ECB to step in.
So what's next for Italy's economy, Melanie, after Draghi's exit? Why is it in such a mess? And is it at risk, do you think, of even crashing out of the eurozone?
We do not see a risk that Italy will crash out of the eurozone. None of the political parties are offering that up. They've learned from the mistakes of before. They would like to stay in the euro, even the most right-wing parties. And so we do not see a risk of that. As it happens, Mario Draghi did resign, and we are heading for snap elections. Does that change the outlook for Italy? We don't think so. So for us, further fiscal support was an upside risk to our forecast. The snap election means that further fiscal support this year is highly unlikely. And that's not because of willpower, but it's more because of logistics. The snap election is being held on the 25th of September. Coalition politics mean that in Italy, it will take time for a governing coalition to form, let alone that new government agreeing on new fiscal aid. So because fiscal support was an upside to our forecast before, now it's no longer there. And we still expect the Italian economy to enter recession by Q4 this year. Our forecasts currently point to growth of 2.7% for this year as a whole, which is lower than what the government has recently forecast.
Really good to talk to you, Melanie. Many thanks indeed for being with us on Counting the Cost.
Of course. Thank you for including me.
Now, it was seen as an act of solidarity in the face of what EU countries say is energy blackmail by Russia. The bloc's watered-down plan to cut gas consumption by 15% comes as Moscow announced another cut to supply, sending prices up once again. Russian energy firm Gazprom says that it's reduced gas flows into Germany to allow work on a turbine on the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. But EU leaders say that move is politically motivated. Al Jazeera's Barbara Angopa reports.
The energy crisis looming over Europe dominated the meeting of EU ministers in Brussels. Cutting gas consumption ahead of winter, the best and only way to reduce EU's reliance on Russian energy.
45 BCM corresponds to a 15% cut in our usual gas consumption between the beginning of August and the end of March. That's why we have pointed to this percentage as the target all member states should strive forward.
Russia is set to further reduce supplies to the Nord Stream pipelines, blaming a technical fault at one of their stations, something EU ministers dispute. EU leaders say there's no technical reason for the latest reduction.
As of today, there is no solution to the ongoing equipment issues at the Portiavaya compressor station. There is no solution whatsoever yet. Siemens is saying nothing. They're trying to find solutions, but there are none.
As the West and Russia exchange economic blows in response to Russia's war in Ukraine, European leaders say Moscow is not a trustworthy partner.
The winter is coming, and we don't know how cold it will be, but what we know for sure that Putin will continue to play his dirty games in misusing and blackmailing by gas supplies.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says Europe is already at war with Russia, and gas is the new front line.
All this is done by Russia on purpose to make it as difficult as possible for Europeans to prepare for winter. And this is an open gas war that Russia is waging against a united Europe. This is precisely how it should be perceived. And they don't care what will happen to the people or how they will suffer, from hunger due to the blockading of ports, or from winter cold and poverty, or from occupation. These are just different forms of terror.
Nearly half of all the gas Europe needs comes from Russia. The supply is now down to a relative trickle. Come winter, if European countries don't have enough supplies stored up in time, rations will almost certainly mean a struggle to heat homes and power cities. Barbara Ngepa, Al Jazeera.
Well, the voluntary agreement may become mandatory if supplies reach crisis levels. However, some countries not connected to the EU's gas pipelines, such as Ireland, Malta and Cyprus, would be exempt. States like Baltic nations that are heavily reliant on gas for electricity can also avoid the reductions. And it's the same for any country that fills its gas storage tanks to the required 80% level, as well as critical industries and supply chains that use gas as a feedstock. Now, an EU official said that Hungary was the only member state that opposed the gas reduction agreement. Let's discuss all of this further with Michael Bradshaw, Professor of Global Energy at Warwick Business School. He joins us now from Coventry in the UK. Michael, good to have you with us once again. What do you make of this deal? How are businesses, factories, households going to be affected?
And as you've suggested, it's a compromise. I mean, a bargain has been struck. There's lots of exemptions. And we must wait and see what happens if we get to a physical shortage of supply. If you look at the kind of measures that are proposed, I think for households, it really means that they are hoping on what we might call behavioural change, that people will take measures to reduce their gas consumption in the winter. I mean, these things are not necessarily hard to do, turning down thermostats, you know, improving the efficiency of your house in terms of insulation, windows, not heating rooms you don't need and so forth. But industry is much harder, particularly the energy-intensive industries. There's already a degree of demand destruction as a consequence of high price. But most countries will probably have in place a system that will actually say to key industries, you need to reduce or stop operating to save gas so that gas can be used to generate electricity and heat households.
It's being described as a show of resolve, a show of solidarity among EU nations, but are they really united in the energy war with Russia?
Well, obviously what President Putin hopes to do is drive discord and disunity among European member states. The fact that they've reached an agreement is a positive, but as your reporters have suggested, it comes with various caveats and exemptions. The other concern among member states is what one might call commission creep, that actually the European Commission is overstepping its mandate here, because responsibility for energy security and an energy mix is actually something that lies with national governments, not the European Union. I think it really will be tested if we get to this emergency situation where they try to make it mandatory. Until then, it's a voluntary agreement and we must wait and see.
All right, given the long list of exemptions, could European nations still fill the gaps left if Russia does turn off the taps completely, especially if Europe faces an exceptionally cold winter?
I think the short answer is no. There's simply not enough gas available in global markets, because most of the other gas will have to come as liquefied natural gas. And it's not just whether or not there's a mild winter in Europe. We've been relatively lucky in Europe that the Chinese demand has been depressed as a consequence of COVID. If we have a hard winter in the Northern Hemisphere that affects Asian LNG demand, we'll be in competition with Asia to try and secure the available flexible LNG. There's simply not enough flexible LNG to cover the gap.
So where does all of this leave the EU's plans to ultimately wean itself off Russian gas?
Well, it's going to take time. There's no question about that. I mean, the backstory here is that the global gas market is exceedingly tight, and the European Union is wanting to pivot away from pipeline gas to relying on seaborne liquefied natural gas. And the market there is going to be tight probably for the next 2 or 3 years at least. And therefore, this is not going to be an easy thing to do, and it's going to come at a very high cost. So driving down demand is a critical element here. But trying to find alternative supplies is going to take time.
Are there options for nations in warmer climates, southern parts of Europe, to share spare capacity with nations in the north?
There are problems here with the gas pipeline network. I mean, one of the reasons that Spain is exempt, that actually, although Spain has a lot of LNG import capacity, the pipeline links between Spain and France are underdeveloped, and therefore the gas that Spain might have an offer to Northern Europe cannot actually make it into European markets. Previous gas disputes between Russia and Ukraine did result in the European Union investing in greater connections within its gas market, but it's not that straightforward to move the gas. It's equally not that straightforward to move the gas from the LNG terminals, because the pipeline system is based on moving lots of gas from Russia.
And what does all of this mean for householders like you and me? I mean, are bills going to stay high now for the foreseeable future? Is this cost of living crunch due to the rising cost in heating costs going to continue?
Unfortunately, I think it is. I think we have to brace ourselves for further increases in price. This morning, I actually just received my gas bill, and I can't believe it. It's so high. It must be a mistake, I'm saying to myself. So I think we're going to see further increases and greater pressure on governments to protect consumers, and that's not going to go away.
On that rather gloomy note, Professor, we'll leave it. Many thanks indeed for being with us. That's Michael Bradshaw there in Coventry.
Thank you.
A UN-brokered deal clearing the way for the export of millions of tons of Ukrainian grain is expected to help ease food prices and the global staple shortage. But getting harvest from the farm to the table has become a dangerous job in Ukraine since the Russian invasion began. Al Jazeera's John Hendren reports now from the village of Krasny.
In a wheat field north of Kyiv, a demining expert sweeps for the weapons of war. The mine detector finds remnants of a cluster bomb. It's slow going, but these workers need to clear a path before farming combines can reap the wheat from a wartime harvest. They're among 1,000 demining experts across Ukraine racing to avert a global food shortage.
Behind me, we have found a fragment of cluster munition and a grenade from an RPG-7, which is unexploded.
When the war began, this farm was attacked by Russian aircraft, artillery, and cluster bombs. Workers had to replace tractors, trucks, and barns before they could bring in the harvest.
You can see they're burned and destroyed by shelling, artillery, and drone strikes.
As farmers scramble to gather wheat, corn, and sunflower oil, Russia and Ukraine have reached a tenuous agreement to allow 20 million tons of trapped Ukrainian grain to leave from Black Sea ports through so-called safe channels. But with all the dangers of transporting the crop of 2022 in a war zone, for now, this farm is storing wheat in these containers.
Wheat is the symbol of Ukraine. That yellow and blue flag represents a field of wheat beneath a sky of blue. And for Ukraine, the problem is getting this wheat out of the ports. But for farms like this, the problem is overcoming all of the obstacles to get it harvested in the first place.
The harvest of war has been tough on farms across Ukraine. Russia has left its signature on these cluster bombs.
Here we can see the mark of Russian forces. Since the beginning of our work, our employees found these on our fields.
The machinery of war rushes the machines on the farm. And as summer winds to a close, the race to bring in this year's crop grows more urgent every day. John Hendren, Al Jazeera, Krasny, Ukraine.
And that's our show for this week. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch with us about anything that you've seen, you can tweet me. I'm at A. Finnegan on Twitter. Please use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. Or you can drop us a line. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our email address. There is, of course, more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That takes you straight to our page, and there you'll find individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. But that's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Adrian Finnegan from the whole team here in Doha. Thanks for being with us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.